You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com. What
do you know? Hello, dear listener. My name is Jonathan Golub. I am the science columnist at The Stranger and bringing you yet another Dear Science podcast after a long delay. With me today on the Stem Cell Liberation Day is David, who is a fellow graduate student at the University of Washington. Thank you for joining, David.
Hi.
David is from Oklahoma, and what's your, like, title was this thing in here?
Oh, I was talking about my job category as something, pre-doctoral research assistant number two.
And David and I are trying to figure out what separates number one and number two in these great titles. Working at a university is a little bit like being in a Kafka novel in every way imaginable. So today, Monday, March 9th, Obama signed an executive order rescinding the Bush-era restrictions. I'm a little older than David. I've been around. I remember the day Bush got on television. This was in August of 2001, one of his first bold masterstrokes of an administration to ban embryonic stem cell research. So, David, do you want to describe a little bit where embryonic stem cells come from?
So embryonic stem cells, as Jonathan knows, and maybe some of the listeners do, are derived from early-stage embryo blastocysts. So these are a fertilized egg is allowed to divide through several divisions. I'm not actually sure. It's only a handful. And then these cells are able to be removed from the blastocyst and then cultured in perpetuity because these cells not only have the ability to turn into other types of cells but are able to what we call self-renew, which means are able to divide and sort of stay young forever until we differentiate them.
So all of the embryonic stem cell lines which we are allowed to work with, according to the Bush rules, had to be created before his announcement in August of 2001. So they basically came from a small number of labs, and in our lab that we work both together in on heart disease, we basically only work with one stem cell line that was created in Wisconsin from blastocysts that were generated, I believe, in Israel. This has been one of the long-standing jokes that most of the Bush-approved stem cell lines were Jewish. And since they were going to hell anyway, I suppose there's sort of a theological consistency to their use. We in our lab have never worked with human embryos at all. So this is the whole point. Because they can make copies of themselves in theory indefinitely, most embryonic stem cell research has nothing to do with creating new embryonic stem cell lines. So in one sense, the Republican talking point that Bush allowed stem cell research, didn't ban it, is true, in the sense that we're not particularly interested in generating new lines ourselves. But Bush's rule says not only can you not generate new lines with federal funding, but you cannot use federal funds on research involving newly generated lines. And because human embryonic stem cells were only first created in 1998, that meant that all federally funded research, which is the overwhelming majority of research in the United States that occurs, had to be done on the very first embryonic stem cell lines. And it's just sort of like when you're making pancakes at home. They're not all that great. They're sort of troublesome and have their own little problems. We've gotten much better at growing them in the near decade of experience just our lab has had with embryonic stem cells, which is about as long as any lab in the country has had. But it would be nice to be able to use newer lines that were created with these more modern techniques. And so let's talk a little bit more about where these embryos come from. So in vitro fertilization involves the mixing of a human egg with human sperm in a dish. And then it will proceed first through a couple solid divisions into a solid ball of cells called a morula. And then eventually it kind of makes this beach ball-like structure. So it's sort of like a beach ball with sand in it. Called a blastocyst, and it's about 75 to 100 cells at that point. The beach ball part of that, the blastocyst, this very early embryo, goes on to form all the supporting structures. And the sand clump at the bottom, it goes on to become all of the tissues in the body. So when you create an embryonic stem cell line, what essentially you're doing is getting rid of the beach ball cells, grabbing that pile of sand in the middle of what used to be in the middle of the beach ball, and growing it up. And growing in conditions that cause the cells to divide, but keep their property of being able to make any cell type in the body. And that's what we work with, and that is a stem cell line. So the one we work with in our lab, the name of it is H7. It's one of about 13 or so, which were created before August 2001, and which were up till today the only lines eligible for federal funding.
Yeah, I think that number underscores just how new the field of stem cell biology was when these when the research was frozen into new lines. The sort of scope of how many lines we have is relatively small and limited. And but as we've, I think with the sort of freeze on creating new lines, it pushed the research towards application, where a lot of labs weren't necessarily able to be in the field of studying what I call stem cell biology in its essence, which is what are these cells, what makes them pluripotent and what makes them self-renew. But instead, we're focused more on studying how to turn them into other cell types, because there wasn't a whole lot of ability to try and make new lines. But there's been an amazing growth in the research in how to use these cells. And we've become quite adept at using only these few lines we've had so far. And it's brought a lot of... I don't think of myself as a stem cell biologist, and I think a lot over the last few years, these cells have become a brand new model system. They aren't the organism, but at the same time, in terms of cell type, they're entirely unique in allowing us to study the process of development without having to look at the embryo itself.
Yeah, I think most people frown on studying human embryos as they're developing. I think, and this is the whole point, is that we are both stem cell biologists, but we're not monsters, I don't quite believe. I'll call myself a stem cell biologist. And I think the other thing to think about is these applications that David refers to, these are alternatives to organ transplantation. Yep. And there's a growing amount of concern over that as well, how one gets enough organs to transplant to treat all the people who need things. And the statistic that I always throw out and keep in mind is that about 2,000 people die every day from heart disease in the United States. And in the whole country, there's about 2,000 heart transplants that can be done in a year, because there just aren't enough hearts. And one of the big goals of this is just generating a whole bunch of replacement heart cells so that we don't need to be scouring around for organs. As numerous and plentiful as Chinese prisoners are, we probably don't want to do it.
Yes, I mean, just using these cells, which are from such an early stage in the developing embryo, allows us to understand development and understand development in a way that leads towards practical application, but it also comes from a pre-implantation embryo. So when thinking about this, this is coming from a byproduct of in vitro fertilization, which I think a lot of people have learned in the last few years. But it's coming from a stage where before it needs to be implanted in order to survive. So before it reaches, I think, that critical ethical standpoint of sort of entering the mother's womb, I mean, it's so amazingly early that these cells are sort of before they ever become human or before they ever become any part of the body. They're totally naive. That's what makes them interesting.
Yeah, and one of the things that is really important to point out is why there are all these excess embryos. It's not just that the IVF industry, which is totally unregulated, is completely irresponsible. There's a problem here. So collecting sperm isn't so difficult. I think we all can agree that's a pretty easy task to accomplish. Collecting unfertilized human eggs is fairly complicated and expensive, and most importantly, dangerous to the woman, much more so than it is for the man to collect sperm. And so you don't want to have to do it more than once. And then you add in the complexity that there isn't really a good technique for freezing unfertilized human eggs and storing them for later. You have to use all of the ones you collected or they're just going to die. Whereas early embryos can be frozen. The technology is available. So when you have a couple that's going through fertility treatments, you collect as many eggs as you can. You fertilize them and then let the embryos go for a short while and then freeze them and then thaw them as you do implantations a few at a time. This is how you avoid having like octomom, you know, having 8 children where many of them end up actually at fairly high risk. The idea is you only want to implant 1 or 2 or 3 at a time. And the way to avoid having to go through a very dangerous collection protocol multiple times is to freeze embryos rather than to go back and have to recollect.
But admittedly, these frozen embryos are, if used within a reasonable window of freezing, viable. I mean, the sort of spectacle of whatever they call those snowflake babies has definitely come across our screen.
Yeah, and And it gets around again where you're going to call a human being, and that actually is sort of out of the purview of science. Although I always find it interesting the very serious conservatives who will make an argument that it has the right number of chromosomes and therefore it's an independent human life. And I think we would agree that there's a lot more to the humanity and making a human being, even at a sort of biological level, than getting the right number of chromosomes in the right place. It's
definitely true that thankfully I've not had to consider too heavily what the embryo is, because as a sort of downstream stem cell lab, we work with what is essentially the tissue culture from the blastocyst of these cells. You know, these cells cannot be put back once they're taken out. You can't recreate a blastocyst from stem cells.
No.
So it does destroy that one blastocyst, which most often is there's the shelf life even in the freezer of a frozen blastocyst is not that long.
No, and then of course once you have a couple has had all the children they want, no one's willing to pay for it. The couple isn't willing to pay for it. The insurance isn't willing to pay for it. Society isn't willing to pay for it. And so the fate of most of these embryos that are excess after the fertility treatment is to be combined with bleach and dumped down the drain. Yeah.
Which makes this more akin to if one is willing to accept the premise that these are whole human life, if not cognizant human life, more akin to the problem of organ transplant and organ harvesting, because these embryos, in the process of in vitro fertilization, which is part of why I think the Catholic Church opposes it altogether, are created in a way such that they won't ever be able to be used. And if they are never to be able to be used again, it makes sense that they be at least applied towards our ability to understand and heal human disease. And I think that is at least the farthest conservative position I could support in terms of ethical debate over stem cell biology, is to treat them closer to organ transplant. It would be, A, absolutely problematic in terms of research approval, but it would at least allow us to use them.
And there are some other subtle points that come out of this. Like, one of the things I always find interesting is this blastocyst stage is before there's individualization.
Mm-hmm.
So if you cut the blastocyst in half, you have identical twins. And
exactly.
This is how identical twins come into being. And if you match two of them together, you'll get a single chimeric human being, which also happens and shows up in clinics sort of unexpectedly from time to time.
I was on House recently.
Oh, see, House. Authoritative in every way. I still want to grow up to be Dr. House, I have to say.
Chimeric XX and chimeric XY.
It's very,
which
very
I think has never actually happened, but is theoretically possible. I think we've forced it to happen in mice.
I think it's that happens in House fairly often. Theoretically possible, not has actually happened. So, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think this signing by Obama of this executive order rescinding Bush's earlier executive order today going to make any difference for us?
I think it won't make any difference until we're at the next 8-year time point, to be honest, in terms of real stem cell biology. We have had such a lag in creating and using and understanding the real pluripotent cell, the stem cell, because of our inability to make new pluripotent lines. I just don't see our sort of the limits we've placed on our use of stem cell technologies catching up to our new ability to use them just yet. I mean, the number of labs that have been able to use new stem cell lines and make new stem cell lines is still absolutely limited, just because of the amount of absolute science capital there is in the United States.
I mean, even among these few lines, we definitely know that there are differences between them. We don't understand, really. So pluripotent means a cell that can become any cell type in the body, but there's pluripotent and then there's pluripotent. And we know, for example, that H1s tend to do better at making neural structures, whereas H7s, two different of these Bush-approved lines, are better at making heart cells. And so we don't quite understand why, because we don't have enough of them to really study it. And this brings up a second point, which is if you want to actually try to treat people and treat diseases with these lines, just like when you have organ transplant, you have to match it. We need to match our stem cells' immune types with the recipients. And there's been a couple papers estimating how many, and the idea is maybe you'd have a bank of a couple hundred different kinds of stem cell lines that would give you pretty comprehensive coverage of the immune types that one observes out in the human population. And that, again, we kind of got caught in a catch-22 in the Bush years, where people would argue against embryonic stem cell research, saying, well, no one's been treated by it, while at the same time prohibiting us being able to work with enough lines to actually practically be able to treat any significant chunk of the human population. And so there are labs that were doing sort of trickery and backhanded stuff to get around this restriction by doing some genetic engineering, but it would be better just to start from scratch and be able to actually have appropriate lines to do it.
No, I think there's definitely research and definitely practical medical application that has been barred for the last 8 years. The problem is because it's been barred, I don't know that the steps leading up to us having it have been done yet, because we weren't able to. So it's going to take, I think, another 8 years to be where we should be in terms of using these lines, or at least four.
We know
some because of what we were able to sort of weasel around.
But not anywhere.
I think we'll be at another election before we're really seeing the fruits of this.
So pay attention, Governor Palin. Your hour is upon you in 8 years. And it goes to show how much of global research, even now, is driven by the United States government and government funding around the entire planet. I mean, there's very fine research being done in other countries, but this is one area where the United States, even after an 8-year pause, still has a nice solid lead and takes leadership on it. So all of you sitting at home buying euros and yuan, this is one thing maybe you have a little pride in your country, is that we as the United States still does a very fine job on biomedical research.
There are particular labs that I think have gotten a foot up by not being in the U.S. during this period. But the thing about it is that talking about the state of the field with probably, I can't speculate, but somewhere it's got to be greater than 3/4 of, laboratory science and stem cells is all based in the U.S., with at least 3/4 of the field unable to work with, reproduce, or understand that research produced outside of the U.S., the whole field itself has been stagnated.
And it's an important field, and this is sort of one of those, about 10 years ago, about 1998, there was sort of a series of breakthroughs that were only now starting to play out in sort of technical ability of biological scientists, including stem cell lines. The Human Genome Project was completed around that time. There is a new technology of which David is quite familiar called microarray or transcriptional profiling, where we could determine where genes are as far as how on or off they are in given populations or samples, all of them at once. And
both of those latter two being sort of applied to what's more known in the sort of media as personalized medicine. Or the hope of personalized medicine.
And then the last thing was this technology called gene knockdown, or siRNA, or small interfering RNA. And so 10 years later, we're starting now to be able to play out of it, and it's been unfortunate that one of these sort of four major breakthroughs was so stymied for so long. Because there's going to, I think, be a fairly strong wave of new understanding of biology. So just even touching on it, and the idea of using not just necessarily stem cells immediately to like replace an organ in the transplant, but to understand how we function as machines and develop new treatments or test drugs much more efficiently. So,
true with the mouse stem cells that we managed to. Mouse stem cells are actually, we understand a little more, we've been able to use them more, and a big part of that is we've seemed to think that how pluripotent a stem cell is depends on how exactly you harvest it, and that sort of discovery of that, at least with the mouse stem cell lines, came through sort of a process of trial and error that happened in the last few years of harvesting in different ways, and the whole idea, I think, that I'm curious about is whether people will be able to harvest a stem cell from a human blastocyst that's more equivalent to the mouse line, maybe. And mouse stem cells are just amazingly much easier and cheaper to culture in terms of use. So, and that's interesting to me, just as a basic scientist.
For sure. And one of the things that's probably going to come out of this is a sort of a burst now that you can expect, and it's already started, the ball's rolling, is right now when you try to develop a new drug for humans, it's an enormously expensive, and the majority of them fail for reasons that were not very well understood. And we're just now being able to get the technology both on the computer side of it and using these four new techniques that I just brought up. To be able to really design drugs much more intelligently and target diseases and things that go wrong in a way that's much more clever, understanding that they're so complex problems, you have to tackle multiple parts at one time. And so you need the combination of knowing which parts are sort of the linchpins or the key things that cause things like high blood pressure or heart attacks or strokes, and at the same time developing drugs that target these multiple places all at one time. And Merck just shut it down, but Rosetta here in Seattle was digging at these problems and is by no means solitary in all of it. We have also this
the ISB.
The Institute for Systems Biology here in Seattle, and SBRI, this is the Seattle Biomedical
and,
Research
and
Institute.
In terms of this stuff, what stem cells in particular as sort of the one of four technologies Jonathan's talking about will allow us to do is, A, try sort of to understand the effects of drugs on each part of the body, each tissue, because we're able to make a single cell from one, say, human type of... histocompatibility type or whatever, or make them into each tissue, but also we're able to understand diseases whose phenotypes, diseases whose effects are sort of built upon small errors through the course of development. We'll be able to understand more about what stages errors may cause disease in, like what part of development of the heart may cause a later effect that's larger and more prominent in terms of human biology.
So it's a good day. And just as one last little parting thing, David is Christian. And just to show that David is a Christian and out as a stem cell willing to work with stem cells. Show that not everyone.
My grandmother's not so happy about that, but.
So if an Oklahoman and who not a single county went for Obama in Oklahoma, right?
Oh no, I think we went 75% for McCain.
McCain Palin. You got to say McCain Palin.
McCain Palin.
There were 75% of Oklahomans who were like, you know, that Palin could make a good president. I really have a good feeling about her someday. So the world is not quite as grim of a place as we would sometimes like to imagine it. And with that, I'd like to thank you, David, for chatting with me. Thank you, listeners, for listening to yet another Dear Science podcast. You can catch me at The Stranger's website, www.thestranger.com, or at dearscience.org. And if you have a question, throw it to me at dearscience@thestranger.com. Thanks for listening.